Chapter 7. My Nightmare. The Cabins. Hurleyville, New York. August, 1966. After a month or so in the new temple, the Swami was acquiring a more regular following. A core group, Janice, Raymond, Keith, Stanley, Howard, and Wally. They hung around the place all the time. Wally, Keith, and Howard lived in an apartment on nearby Mott Street, and a few of them actually slept on the floor of the temple. With them around so much, the Swami began holding a program each morning, during which he would lecture and chant with whoever was there. I heard about the morning programs and started to walk over to the storefront occasionally in the early hours of the morning. The hours before 7 were the only time of the day when Lower Manhattan was relatively quiet. Usually the area was noisy, smelling, and choking with refuse, overflowing garbage cans festering in the heat on every street corner. Almost totally devoid of trees, shrubs, or plants, the street's only living inhabitants besides humans appeared to be mosquitoes and rats. During the early morning hours, though, things took on a dreamlike quality. Without all the cars, the air was less toxic. It was warm, but not yet hot, so the garbage stank less. And with only a few people around, the atmosphere changed from metropolis to quiet neighborhood. I really liked being up at that hour. Some mornings I could even hear birds singing in Sarah Roosevelt Park as the sun rose. Although I was attending the Swami's programs and reading his books a lot, I wasn't part of his core group. That group didn't do a whole lot for me, and I wasn't interested in just hanging around. One afternoon, I dropped by the Swami's apartment and found about 8 men sitting cross-legged on the floor, leaning against the wall of his small, unfurnished bedroom. An intense philosophical discussion was underway, mostly fueled, I thought, by the fact that they had nothing else to do. Patiently listening to their comments, the Swami sat opposite them on a sponge rubber-covered mattress, covered by a white sheet. "So the mode of goodness is called sattva, right?" one of them asked. "Yes, that's right," the Swami answered. "And does sattva lead to the mode of pure goodness?" "Yes, but according to the Vedic understanding, the modes of raja and tamas, passion and ignorance, are always attacking sattva," the Swami said. I wasn't in a hurry, so I sat and listened for a while, trying to look inconspicuous. The boys talked on, and eventually the Swami lay down on his side and drifted off into sleep. The group was silent. "The Swami takes short naps," one of them whispered to me. "We shouldn't talk until he wakes up." I thought about leaving, but stayed sitting against the wall. 20 minutes later, the Swami sat up and the conversation resumed exactly where it had left off. I was surprised that he seemed so fully alert and could remember what was being discussed before he went to sleep. The conversation seemed endlessly conjectural and rather speculative to me. I liked the Swami's teaching, but this type of discussion seemed a bit pointless. I had a partner, a career, and a life to get on with. I quietly slipped away to meet up with a friend named Henry Salmon, who that afternoon had invited Jan and me to accompany him and his girlfriend Julie for a week away in rural Hurleyville, New York. We liked the idea of getting out of the city for a week or so, so we agreed to go with Henry. I hadn't known him for long, but we had a really good rapport. His girlfriend seemed quite young, but fun and sweet enough. The four of us drove up to Hurleyville the following afternoon. "There's 4 cabins," Henry said as we headed out of the city on the freeway. "My family owns them. We'll have 2. And they've rented the other 2 out to other people. It's really nice up there, clean and secluded." At 6 o'clock on the first morning, I discovered that the water tap in our cabin wasn't working. So much for rural life. I left Jan sleeping and went next door to Henry's cabin to get a drink. Henry wasn't in, but the door was unlocked, so I let myself in to get some water from the kitchen. Unknown to me, Julie was asleep in the adjacent bedroom. I also didn't know that she was only 15 years old. 3 years younger than Henry, and that she had sold marijuana to a local undercover agent the previous afternoon when we arrived in Hurleyville. I gazed absently out Henry's kitchen window as I drank my glass of water. The sun's rays were just beginning to rise above the pine trees, and I could hear a stream flowing somewhere nearby. "We'll have to check that out later today," I thought. I rinsed the glass and turned off the tap tightly so it wouldn't drip like it had before I turned it on. "Was that sirens I heard in the distance? They seemed to be getting louder and louder. Suddenly they were screaming right outside the window, cars lurching and skidding onto the grass, red lights flashing in the windows. What's going on?" I heard myself say. I rushed through the cabin's open front door. Police crouched behind their cars, guns drawn. One cop, halfway up the stairs of the cabin, lunged at me with his pistol drawn. You're under arrest, he shouted. Put your hands in the air. Bewildered, I slowly raised my hands above my head. It was hard to take seriously. I felt like I was watching a TV drama in which things like that occurred regularly, except this was all unfolding in slow motion. This was a dream. It couldn't have been happening. The officer shoved his cocked Smith & Wesson 45 into my stomach and waved a piece of paper at my face. Henry Salmon, this is your arrest warrant. You have the right to remain silent. Whatever you say may be used as evidence against you in a court of law. I was relieved. This was one drama I wasn't going to be a part of. There's been a mistake, officer, I said. I'm not Henry. My name's Michael Grant, and I just came over here for some water. Our faucet next door isn't working. Doesn't matter, shouted another cop, overruling me. You were in the house. To his colleague, the one with the gun, he said, take him in as well. The officer with the gun forced my hands behind my back. I felt the cold steel of handcuffs around my wrists and his hands forcing me down into the chair. The reality of the situation hit me. This wasn't a movie. This was for real. The policeman fanned out throughout the house, marching with heavy steps into the kitchen and the bathroom. They went through my pockets. Empty. Suddenly, Jan was there, fear and confusion in her eyes. Two burly policemen stood in the doorway just in case I'd make a run for it. They blocked her from entering. What's this all about? She sounded panicky. They think I'm Henry, I shouted. Tell them that I'm not. This is ridiculous. I have my ID next door. We are staying next door, she said, and he's not Henry. Can you let him go, please? We have things to do today. Shut up, snapped one of the cops by the door. This is none of your business. But Michael's my fiancé, she insisted. We exchanged a look. Fiancé? It was worth a try. We're just up here for a week. You made a mistake. Without looking at her, the policeman said rudely, Why don't you go home, lady? We got a job to do. You keep your mouth shut or you're going downtown too. Jan backed away, but hovered outside the doorway. More cars pulled up, and the state and federal police swarmed into the small cabin. An officer in a blue uniform, his gun in a holster, emptied the kitchen cabinets and pulled out silverware drawers, rifling through their contents. He looked in boxes under the sink, opened handy-andy bottles, Ajax cans, bags of flour. He flung open the fridge and freezer doors and even ripped into bags of frozen vegetables. I could see an officer going into the small bathroom. He lifted the lid on the water tank behind the toilet. Peering inside, another patrolman stood at the door. Anything there? Nope. More policemen combed the cupboards. Looking under the table, inside the light fixtures, on the shelves, at the back of the curtains, inside colored flower vases, beneath the cover linings, and behind pictures on the wall. So far, no one had gone into the bedroom. The door was shut, and I assumed Henry and Julie were out somewhere. Finally, four policemen stormed the room. Seconds later, Julie staggered out in a pale green, thigh-length nightgown, rubbing the sleep out of her eyes. Boy, I thought, she's a deep sleeper. Maybe she's taken something. A policeman clutched one of her upper arms as he escorted her out. He cuffed her hands behind her back. I wasn't surprised to see her shaking. She'd awakened to four uniformed men ransacking her bedroom. She sunk into a kitchen chair near mine. I heard voices shouting in the bedroom, furniture moving, drawers opening, shoes scuffing the floor, window shades opening, jewelry rattling, cosmetic bottles clanging. Look between the mattresses. Hey, look what Daddy found, someone said in a loud bass voice. White shafts of sunlight drifted through the window in the front room, piercing the air in the small kitchenette. Particles of flour rose slowly to the ceiling. Peas rolled languidly on the floor. Jan had inched her way inside and was talking diplomatically to a plainclothes detective, but both of them stopped talking when they heard the exclamation from inside the cabin. The policeman emerged from the bedroom holding a small plastic bag between his thumb and forefinger. He clomped into the kitchen. It was in one of those drawers. Let me see that, the sergeant in charge demanded, grabbing the clear plastic bag and scrutinizing it. Yep, this looks like it. He held it to his nose and sniffed, nodded his head, and others came in for a closer look. Another black and white Ford screeched to a stop outside, red light still revolving. I got him. He's here in the car, I heard the driver shout. The door slammed, and a flushed-looking officer appeared in the cabin doorway. It's Henry, he said. I found him. Satisfied now, the officers prepared to leave the scene. One grabbed me and another grabbed Julie. They led us down the front stairs. My arm felt bruised underneath the hard clamp of the officer's grip. Henry was alone in the back seat. He looked small and frightened, sitting in that police car. His goatee, stubble, mustache, and hair made him look like a criminal. He peered out at us through the car window. As we came down the steps, I felt his anguish, but I was relieved. He was the person named on the warrant, not me. They'd gotten their man. "Can I go now?" I asked demandingly, to no one in particular. "No way, buddy. You're coming with us." "What?" The policeman holding me pushed me into the car, his hand on my head, just like on TV. Julie was pushed into the back seat from the other side of the car. Henry sat in the middle between us. For half a minute, we were alone while local, state, and federal police planned their next move. "The best thing," I whispered, not looking at them, "is if you don't say anything at all." I tried to sound resolute and wise. I was 6 years older than Henry, and I knew I could pull a little rank on him. "We'll get our lawyers to talk to them." Then I looked straight at them. "Whatever we say, they'll use against us. It's best not to say anything, okay? I'm sorry you guys are in this situation, but I don't want to be involved in this. It's nothing to do with me." Out of the corner of my eye, I saw the policeman coming toward us. A bad-tempered New York State patrolman slammed the driver's door and drove us away, fast. We headed toward the freeway in silence. The car's clean seats, floor panels, and dust-free dashboard looked and smelled like the inside of a hospital. "Why did you arrest me when you didn't have a warrant for me?" I asked. "I don't talk to idiots," he hissed, looking at me in the rearview mirror, not turning his head. He drove faster. "This is so unjust," I thought. "I don't have any weed on me." As we approached the station, my mind was racing. I'd heard many stories about false arrests, erroneous convictions, and even wrongful executions. I had visions of a long prison sentence ahead. For the police, having marijuana was the same as having narcotics, and it amounted to a serious misdemeanor, almost a felony. And even though I wasn't in possession of any drugs, I was with Henry, and that seemed to be enough for them. The car pulled up outside the station, and I was taken immediately for an initial hearing before a judge. The judge looked me up and down as I entered the room, flanked by two police officers. I was bearded and dressed shabbily. The judge looked pointedly at my gold earring. I heard him mutter under his breath, "If my kid ever looked like that, I'd beat the crap out of him." The police briefed him on the arrest. I was charged with possession of narcotics with intent to sell, statutory rape, and contributing to the delinquency of a minor. I was put in prison on $5,000 bail, with the formal trial scheduled to take place in 2 weeks. 20 minutes later, I was booked, photographed, and fingerprinted. As I stood before the cameras, the state policeman who had driven us to the station said to the police photographer, "We caught him in bed with Henry's girlfriend." "That's a lie," I snapped. He strolled over and kicked my leg as hard as he could. "Can't stand the truth?" I shouted. He kicked me again and glared. It hurt too much for me to say anything but, "Ouch." The Hurleyville and state police treated me like a hardened criminal. They hardly talked to me. And when they did, they shouted and cursed at me. They shoved me around and pushed me from room to room. I spent 5 days at the Hurleyville City Prison. I was in a cell with a toilet that had no seat on it. I wrote a letter to a relative asking him if he would pay my bail. I began to doubt if the letter even got out of the prison. I fasted, protesting a false arrest, but no one seemed to notice. Finally, on the fourth day, I succumbed to hunger. I told the guards I was a vegetarian. "You think this is a restaurant where you can order whatever you want?" they sneered. I was given 3 pieces of white bread and a hot dog that I dumped into the toilet. To remind myself how little nutrition I was getting, I squished each slice of bread into a cube the size of a dice. I remember repeatedly requesting a phone call, and after 4 days managed to speak to Jen for 30 seconds. "You've got to get me out of here." "Don't worry, I will," she said. "I'm doing everything I can. I'm coming up to see you soon." "I've already been here 4 days, I whispered. "Why hasn't anyone visited me? Do you think maybe Henry and his friends are setting me up?" The guard standing near me said, "Time's up." "Okay," I said, glancing at him. I felt the urgency of the situation in the pit of my stomach. "When are you coming up?" "Tomorrow. I'll try tomorrow," she said. The only things to read in jail were worn paperbacks, mostly Zane Grey cowboy stories. There were no newspapers or radios allowed. Everyone else in the cell block was playing solitaire. Time dragged on. Judging from the stories the other inmates told, I thought I could be inside forever. I was scared, angry, and felt completely helpless. Then I remembered Krishna and the Swami. I remembered what I had read in the Swami's books. And I remembered the Swami saying that chanting helped a person transcend material suffering. The Swami had written specifically about that in a section I had just read before leaving for Hurleyville. Those entangled in the complicated meshes of birth and death can be freed immediately by even unconsciously chanting the holy name of the Lord. I began to chant Hare Krishna, and it made things a little easier. Although I was uneasy about the injustice of my situation and the possibility of prolonged incarceration, my newfound affiliation with the Swami gave me a philosophical perspective that helped me to somewhat transcend this horrible experience. I chanted and chanted, and I calmed down a little bit. The next day, a prison guard came to my cell, his keys rattling as he swaggered. "Grant, you have a visitor." He opened the door and led me out. I followed him down a narrow stairway to the visiting cubicle. Jen was on the other side of the wired glass, looking earnest and cheerful. "You'll get out today." I could tell she was trying to look bright. "Don't worry, I got the best lawyers in New York." A tall, clean-shaven guard appeared behind me, smirking. "We're going back. Come on." "Hey, I haven't been here for 1 minute," I exclaimed. "Tough." He looked impassive as he took me by the upper arm, literally yanking me away. "Back upstairs," he said, nodding to the right. I looked back at Jan. Her mouth was open wide in astonishment, but she quickly shut it and nodded reassuringly. That night, the same tall guard marched up to my cell. "Grant, get your stuff and come with me." He opened the door, and I followed him. I was getting out. At last, Jan was there waiting for me. She looked overwhelmed. She briefed me on the situation on the drive back to New York. "I got one of your uncles in Oregon to pay the bail," she said. "I'm really freaked out by the trial," I said. "How am I going to wait 2 weeks to find out what's going to happen to me?" "Don't worry," she said. "I've been in touch with Maury Spirit, and he's got really great lawyers to represent you, and he's going to front the money for your trial." Yeah, I thought, if anyone could get good lawyers, it'd be him. Maurice was a graduate of Columbia University, a good friend of mine. He liked Eastern culture, like I did, and was keen on LSD, but he was also clean-cut and had numerous contacts in the professional world. His mother, Ophelia Mendoza, worked for the United Nations. With the help of his mother, he'd managed to secure the services of two lawyers named Dominic Strasky and Morris Novak. They were older, experienced attorneys. Novak had worked as a judge for many years in Brooklyn and had been involved in many high-profile cases. Jan, Maurice, and Ophelia thought they were the best people to help me. I met with the lawyer several times over the next 2 weeks. Apart from Maurice and Jan, the rest of my friends and acquaintances seemed to have dissolved. Only the Swami made the effort to call me a few days after I arrived home, and his care and thoughtfulness impressed me and touched me deeply. On the evening of my trial, the lawyers arrived at my loft to drive Jan and me up to Hurleyville. I had shaved my beard off and had my hair cut for the hearing. I wore a dark blue suit and a tie. As I followed them down our front steps, I saw a brand new Buick parked at the curb. Slipping into the back seat, I felt reassured to be supported by such affluent men. The car smelled like new shoes. Mostly we drove in silence. Then I saw Novak watching me in the rearview mirror. "If the judge asks you if you ever used marijuana, you have to say no. Don't even say you've ever tried it, even once. The more indignant you act by being asked this question, the better." I nodded. It was dark by the time we arrived in Hurleyville. We were escorted into a big courtroom that was packed with people. The judge that had presided over my first hearing sat at the front of the room. He looked up as we entered and rose. "Good evening, Judge Novak," he said. Novak nodded to acknowledge him and motioned for me to sit down in the rows of seats in the back of the room. It was then that I realized that all the people in the room were there for their own trials. After endless child support, rent arrears, and traffic cases, the judge rose and walked down the aisle. He paused when he reached us. "Please come with me for a moment," he said to my lawyers. The three of them disappeared into a back room. A few minutes later, my lawyers returned and took their places, one on either side of me. "You don't need to worry," Novak whispered. "It's going to be okay." "Case number 7523, a clerk read out. "The State of New York versus Michael Grant on charges of statutory rape, contributing to the delinquency of a minor, and possession of narcotics with intent to sell. Case dismissed for lack of evidence." Relief coursed through me. Jan was beaming next to me. With sedate smiles and a final nod to the judge, my lawyers led us from the room. The lawyers were almost completely silent on the ride back to the city. Jan and I also exchanged only a few words. "I'm going to see the Swami tomorrow," I said quietly to her. "I want to tell him what's happened with all this." She nodded. "I mean, I don't want him to think I was dealing drugs," I paused, and a thought suddenly occurred to me. "Actually, Carl says that he used to deal drugs." "Did you know that? The Swami dealing drugs? Maybe he wouldn't care that much if I was selling, but I want to clear it up anyway." Jan laughed. "The Swami wasn't a drug dealer," she exclaimed. "He was a pharmacist in Allahabad. That was his job when he was younger. Really? Yes, Carol told me, and he told her. Carl obviously misunderstood him. Imagine that, the Swami a drug dealer. The thought of it, mixed with the relief we felt, we laughed the rest of the way back to New York.